Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hello, everybody. I'm Chad Wesley Smith, and this is another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. Joined, as always, by mischievous Max Montana. And the look on that man's face screams mischief. And our guest today, Dr. Andy Galpin, PhD in... I'd already forgot it.
Oh, you were so close.
It was a fancy one.
Human biometrics.
No. Close, though.
Human bioenergetics.
There you go. Bioenergetics.
PhD in human bioenergetics. Professor at Cal State Fullerton.
Yep.
All-around fancy guy. He's been on a lot of podcasts recently.
Lesser podcasts.
Yeah.
Joe DeFranco, Joe Rogan. Now he's down here slumming it with us non-Joes here on The Jug Life. And we were actually just on his podcast, Barbell Shrugged, about an hour ago.
Yep. And you both tanked terribly, so hopefully I can fix some of that.
Yeah, they said they were cutting me out of that one.
Yeah, I mean, if you thought that was bad, get ready for the next 3.5 hours of your life. So Andy's specialité is muscle biopsies.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? For those people who don't know, I obviously already know, but if they don't know.
That's asking for a friend.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess one of the things that makes me unique is I actually am an athlete, became athlete. I still work with athletes. I competed in college football. Then we started competing in weightlifting, and I still work with a lot of combat athletes, UFC fighters, things like that. And so when I was going through school, and I realized, like, there's nobody that actually looks at these anaerobic athletes, these strength, speed, power athletes, but actually from inside the cell, the muscle perspective. And I always tell the story, but the easiest way I can explain what I do is I remember being taught and learning and figuring out, hey, 10 sets of 3 is very different than 3 sets of 10, right? Coaches have known this for decades, not confusing at all. But no one could ever explain to me why that happens. From the level of the muscle, it was 30 repetitions no matter what. However you slice it, how does the muscle know in one sense to grow, in the other sense to not necessarily grow, but get stronger? And everyone would always say things like, oh, it's neurological. And I, from the second I heard that, I thought, like, this is horseshit. Like, no way is that true. I'm not saying it's totally untrue, but there has to be something different at the muscle level as well. So I wanted to be the guy that, like, I want to figure that out. I want to be the person that looks into that because I understand the strength stuff and the sport and the training enough. If I can add that biochemistry and molecular perspective to it, then we can maybe start answering some questions. So what I do is I take folks like yourself and we talk and we take questions like real training questions, and then we take biopsies. So we take a needle that's like the size of a pen, and I jam it into people's legs, and I withdraw it and take a bunch of muscle. And then we study the crap out of it from the single cell level.
Do you give the muscle back when you're done, or is that's just gone?
That's your donation to science, my friend.
What if that's the one where all my gains were?
Yeah, then you got a real problem. That's why you can't squat. It's because of those 100 milligrams.
How many muscle biopsies have you had on yourself?
Probably 40.
40.
I think the most I've had in one day is 8.
Mostly on your shoulders, I can see. That's where the muscle biopsies are.
Are you saying my shoulders are small? Is that what you're saying? I had one time we did a trial. We were looking at how much muscle glycogen is used during, like, repeated interval cycling stuff. So,
like, this just sounds like it's going to be a very painful session.
So I had a biopsy of my left thigh, my right thigh, my left soleus, my right soleus. I think we did 15 rounds of 30 on, 30 off.
Each time with a muscle biopsy?
No, just, like, on the bike. And then when you finish that, it was another quad biopsy, another soleus biopsy, another soleus biopsy.
How painful is that?
Not very painful,
really?
Honestly. No, it's not. I would say it's actually, pain's not the right word because there's not necessarily pain receptors in muscle.
That deep, or at all?
Not really. There's pressure receptors.
Pain is only
the mental weakness.
Concept of the mind.
Exactly.
Oh. Hasn't Quinn explained that to you?
Right, yes, Quinn has explained that. Yes.
Yeah, I could hook you up with this guy. Like Quinn, he talks about breathing and stuff, and it's all neurological, your back pain.
Yeah, he's a heavy breather, yeah.
Right. It kind of feels like, honestly, you're taking your knuckle and just kind of like doing that, but it's over that fast.
Oh, wow.
So it doesn't linger around like a gunshot wound or anything. The second the needle's gone, it's gone. I've probably biopsied, I mean, hundreds of people at this point, and I've never heard anybody say that hurt.
Oh.
I've heard a lot of people say, like, look, that was weird.
Oh, okay.
And that's like the reaction that we usually get. We've done one, if it makes you feel any better, of the soleus. Had people run a marathon and then did another soleus as soon as they finish.
Well, they probably didn't know what the hell's going on when they finish.
Is there any danger of the muscle damage, like being damaged?
Is there any danger? I guess in theory, but
like, has anyone ever torn a muscle after that? Or
no, we did one. Actually, I had Mike and Doug were in this study. We did a biopsy. We did 8 sets of 3 at 85% of a clean pull, and in between each set, we did a max isometric mid thigh pull, and then another biopsy, and then all that again, and then a third biopsy. So you can do them, keep training. We do them all the time.
How big was the PR after that?
Well, this is Doug Larson and Mike Bledsoe, yeah. Barbell Shred podcast, guys. Name drop. The match that we're just on. And, he sucked all the muscles out of them by the looks of it.
That's why they're so weak and pathetic, if you haven't seen them. Yeah. No, it's not really that big a deal. It sounds and looks a lot scarier than it actually is.
So let's get to some of the information that is being derived from pulling all these muscles out of people. And I think some of the stuff that's maybe most pertinent to our audience, you know, powerlifters, weightlifters, for the most part, as far as I know, listening to this, I haven't really...
fitness models.
Oh, well, yeah.
Okay, a lot
it's not like it's your job to know to listen to your podcast, right?
They listen with the sound off.
Yeah, that's they watch video.
They do now.
Yeah. Is, he was talking about male fitness models anyway.
That's why I did it.
Yeah. Is
if you're thinking about keeping focused, I'm not the guy that's going to keep you on track, just so you know.
Yeah, that's my job, I suppose. Is the idea of transitional fibers.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you compete in a sport that is of the one rep max, so that is a fast twitch dominant sport in, you know, kind of colloquial thinking, does sets of 10, does aerobic work cause a long-term detriment to that athlete, or is it going to be potentially beneficial?
Well, you would have to put a lot of context into that. So I get this question a tremendous amount. My good friend Jimmy Bagley published a really cool study, or it's an analysis, a review of the quote-unquote interference effect of endurance exercise on strength. And his data and their data actually show quite clearly it's not necessarily what we think it is. So it's not as bad. But it really depends on a spectrum. So, for example, if you are a powerlifter and you're trying, and you're 6 weeks out, and you're trying to break a world record, you probably don't need to be going for a jog. Like, that's probably not helping the system. But if you're in your second year of ever training and you're talking about long-term athletic development, well, these are entirely different questions. If you're 30 years old and been training for 12 years,
right,
versus if you're 21 and this is your first year of training, you probably need more long-term development. And you can call that aerobic base if you want, and weightlifting and powerlifting, we call that GPP. It's really not that different.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, the modality can be, but these are the better answers to those questions of what are we really doing. Depends on where you're at, where your training history is at, and what your weakness really is. So if you're so, we'll call it unfit, that you can't get through a traditional strength training session, that's a longer session, maybe with a lot of sets, short reps, but a lot of sets, that still has an aerobic component to be able to get through the entire workout.
Right.
If you don't have that requisite fitness, then maybe adding some baseline conditioning to you is going to improve you, and it may detriment your strength a little bit initially, but it's probably going to allow you to train much longer, more often.
Right.
Who would have thunk that context is important to things?
It's very odd.
And I'd imagine so much of the problem of adding that type of work in, let's say jogging, to continue with that example, wouldn't be from a transitional fiber standpoint.
Sure.
It would be of a fatigue management issue. It would be of joint health. You know, if a man of advanced size, such as myself, was in a, you know, jaunt about the neighborhood, that may be tough on the joints.
Yeah. So we know from muscle fibers perspectives. So maybe we'll just back up to the initial one, because I still get this question a lot, and it blows my mind, of whether or not you can actually change your fiber type. And so we can just answer that right now for you at home.
Cut to commercial break.
Insert sponsor plug. Just kidding. Pause for dramatic. Absolutely. Not only can you change fiber type, but you can change in both directions. So you can change your fast twitch to slow twitch, and your slow twitch can go to fast twitch. And it actually happens extremely quickly. So we have data that suggests it happens in as little as 14 days.
What if I needed to change in a week? I also need to lose about 15 pounds.
So
is that possible?
Yeah, totally. Well, so here's the thing, actually, because it's not... This is maybe answer the question even better. Yeah, it actually is possible. What determines any physiological adaptation is not days. It's exposure, right? I mean, this is basic training stuff. Why did Bulgarian stuff work for strength? Because you gave yourself more exposure.
Right.
But what's the compromise, the limitation to that? Well, if you give yourself too much exposure, now we get injured.
Right.
So it's no different with fiber type. It's no different with any physiological component. Almost anything can change except for your, you know, inherited genome. But anything else can do it given enough exposure. And exposure either means acute time or repetition. So you can change your fiber type in 7 days, theoretically. But what would you have to do? Something of extreme exposure.
Right.
For example, go to space for 7 days, you'll change your fiber type.
Well, simple as that. Get Elon Musk on the phone.
All right.
Right? The other end of the spectrum would be
Musk line.
If you took somebody who's not training and put them through just a Bulgarian training system, and then you added in a cross-country workout in the same day,
right,
you would probably see a dramatic fiber type change in 7 days, but that's not sustainable. It's not going to work. You're going to break all these things. So it's not the physiological limitation that gets you. It's your ability to sustain training exposure.
If you have exposure, and that correct me, please, but if the exposure is to a different stressor, right? So if you're doing, let's say you've maintained, you're doing this, you know, whatever, 100% intensity for 6 months now, every single workout,
mm-hmm.
which is extreme. If the actual stress changes, right, like going to space, atrophy, if you mm-hmm. reduce the amount of volume you're doing, just completely reduce training, that reduction of fatigue, all of those factors can create that situation where you would have a change in fiber type.
So we have seen, so I'll give you a good taper example.
Right.
We did a really cool project 7 or 8 years ago with a cross-country team. And we biopsied them. We did a whole bunch of testing, performance testing, VO2 max, blood, like all these things. And we did it at the beginning of season, and then we did it 3 weeks before their last competition. So basically it was a three-week taper. So at the beginning of their three-week taper, at the end of their three-week taper. Training volume went down 50% over the course of those 3 weeks, which is, in the aerobic world, that's like a textbook taper.
Right.
We don't necessarily get that much in weightlifting, powerlifting, but it just depends on the athlete. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. But that's a pretty standard number. So 21-day taper, 50% reduction in volume, with virtually no reduction in intensity.
Right.
This is, something standard. Novel to the endurance training world. Right. We were like, welcome to weightlifting.
Right.
But what was interesting is their VO2 max did not change over the 3 weeks.
Right.
Fitness is extremely stable. Physiology in those senses are stable. Skill is not as stable. Skill is something you got to keep up all the time, which is why you would never go the last 3 weeks before a competition and not take your reps.
Right.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot about that in a concept we call SRA, stimulus recovery adaptation, and these different length SRA curves, technique being a very short one.
Yes.
I usually give in seminars with that is like, we'll take powerlifting on one side of the spectrum, extremely high force and great, you know, physical and neurological load versus maybe a golf swing.
Sure.
Extremely technical, very low.
Extreme skill.
Yeah. But no, you know, PGA golfer is like, oh yeah, I play, you know, Tuesdays and Fridays with my buddies.
Yeah.
it's 18 in the morning, 18 in the afternoon.
It's 1,000 swings a day.
Yeah. Because you become, you know, rusty so fast.
Absolutely.
A squat or deadlift, much lower on the skill spectrum. You're not going to get rusty that fast. You could do them, you know, once a week, twice a week.
Right.
And still can manipulate that for greater improvement.
So in this example, add a third criteria over here, which would be, call it muscle size, call it cardiovascular fitness. And that would be even further down if on the right-hand side was golf and in the middle was powerlifting. On the left-hand side would be the true physiology, which is even more stable
mm-hmm. right.
than those. Because strength still is skill relative to VO2 max, relative to heart rate. Not as much of a skill as the golf swing, but there is still some skill component too. So a powerlifter, a weightlifter, a few days out, you're still going to take some reps where a cross-country runner doesn't really need the repetitions.
Right.
Cardiovascular especially. Like, it's not going to matter. So VO2 max.
Forget how to jog.
Right. And their heart's not going to forget how to pump.
Right.
Biopsy-wise, here's what gets really interesting. The oxidative or aerobic metabolism, the enzymes that make them produce aerobic energy, also didn't change over the course of the 3 weeks. This is what endurance athletes are terrified. I'm going to lose my fitness. But what happened from the muscle's perspective, you've got slow twitch and fast twitch fibers, and there's much more than that. But just for this conversation, we'll keep it right there. The slow twitch fibers virtually didn't change, but the fast twitch fibers during your 3 weeks of taper increased size by like 25%. So they saw massive hypertrophy in the 2A fibers after 3 weeks of just not running as much. So
you've proved that running kills your gains.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, that's the takeaway, kids.
There you go.
Post that. That's your Instagram clip. We don't know if it actually was inducing hypertrophy or what happened. Probably, my thought is, all the training was compromising, and then when you backed off, it just came back to normal.
Makes sense.
So that actually is the real answer to the beginning question is, like, yeah, you can really change those things really, really, really fast, and something as little as changing volume can absolutely do it, depending on if you're really beat up. So if, I would imagine, we've never done this, but if you went through like a serious 8 or 10 week training phase that had a lot of volume in it, and then you backed off, I guarantee you 3-4 weeks later, your fibers are different.
Yeah.
Fiber type, fiber size, something about it, they've probably adapted and changed. Especially if you add in, oh, I was cutting weight and calories. Now I'm eating again. I've brought carbs back in. Then you're going to see, we've seen carbohydrate. So high fat, high sugar diets alter fiber type.
Really?
Absolutely. And that's been shown pretty
well. So if I do no lifting and I eat high fat, high sugar Snickers bars, let's say.
Yeah. You actually counteract yourself because the high fat, high sugar is going to kick you toward more towards fast twitch.
Okay.
But the lack of training will kick you in the other direction.
He's peaked. He's very...
Yeah.
I just want the recipe for how do I get jacked on Snickers bars and sitting on the couch.
Well, you're going to have to talk to the Bulgarians and the pharmacists out there because that will help.
I think a lot of good takeaways from that, particularly as it relates to something that we're, you know, very fond of promoting, is this idea of phasic structure to training and having times that are dedicated to higher rep phases versus the peaking phases and not, you know, sort of this boogeyman of if I do a bunch of 8s and 10s,
sure.
I'm gonna be weak forever.
Yeah.
And you know, the argument against the Max Montana squatting life of 13 years of max singles only.
Yeah.
And the hypertrophy that it created is
Can't see below the table.
Yeah. Well, this is we can even add some more muscle physiology to that as well in terms of we have some initial data that we're still working out that the fiber type specific response is very much dependent upon the rep range. So if you spend extended periods of time doing the same or standardized repetition range, it's very likely a significant portion of your muscle fibers are not really being challenged.
Right.
You think that's not going to leave a hole in your physiology?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're going to be in trouble.
That's really interesting because that's something I've always noticed and about myself is that lesser than ideal hypertrophy of the body, but having spent basically 13 years with only single repetitions, I never really got any bigger. I never got noticeable gains in muscular size. But something really interesting was that I was always able to stay in these really, like, I could probably walk in the gym almost any day and squat 500 pounds, you know, with almost zero training. Which is kind of funny. It's just interesting that you're saying like the spectrum of muscle fibers has not been trained, but this one particular, the adaptations in this one particular very, very specific range are probably intact for, seemingly a long time, I would say. Right?
Yeah, and I would imagine if any day you walked in and did 10s, you would have been crushed.
Yeah, no, there's no way I could do...
You would have been horrible.
Yeah, it'd be easy to do the same thing I was doing for 13 years, obviously.
You wouldn't be able to do 10 at 50%. Different. You would have been smashed.
Yeah.
Where most of us could do 70% for 10ers or something like that in that ballpark. We can even... Like, the other parts of that, too. Like, we know that... I'm sure you guys are familiar with the post-exercise anabolic window.
Mm-hmm.
This is the window of gains, right?
Yes, yes.
Well, actually, some very new data, I mean, literally in the last week or two, out of my lab, my postdoc, Irene Tobias, has some new data to suggest that that's actually specific to the fiber type. So the fast twitch fibers have a far different anabolic range post-exercise than the slow twitch fibers do. And so here's where we can actually enter in potentially to some athlete-specific prescriptions where we realize, okay, Chad, you're much more fast twitch. it's more important for you to get your food in within 30 minutes, but you are actually a little more slow twitch max or whatever, so you have a larger range.
You have the lame, okay, debatable. You have
the lame one. Debatable. Okay. It'd probably be the opposite. I mean, it's preliminary.
Probably the opposite, yeah.
but this is what we would eventually get to with some of the science stuff, is actually improving individualized training prescription.
Right.
Of one of many things.
So let's shift gears here. Great information there about fiber type and how it's going to relate to training. So we have a book, oh, Unplugged, by Brian McKenzie, Dr. Andy Galpin, and Phil Wild. Phil White, sorry. Dr. Andy Galpin, that's you.
Hey.
So when is this book about?
So the subtitle is Evolve from Technology to Upgrade Your Fitness, Performance, and Consciousness. So if any of you at home know Brian McKenzie's work, his last book was a New York Times bestseller called Unbreakable Runner. He was the one who started CrossFit Endurance, and like a movement guy, really just a pure movement guy. And so the way that the book came about was he just got really, really, really tired of the athletes he was dealing with and the things that they were saying to him that their heart rate monitors were telling them or their HRVs were telling them, and they weren't paying attention to how they actually felt. And he came to me about this was his idea for the book, and I was experiencing similar things with the athletes that I work with. And we were like, you know what? I'm tired of people outsourcing their own physiology and their own coaching to these technologies that they think are smart. Because I work as a scientist on the back end a lot with some of these technology companies. So these wearable technologies, a bunch of them, they come to me and I work with it. And you all would be so shocked at how inaccurate that these things are.
Right.
Even the big ones, the billion-dollar companies, I mean, if you look at the scientific data, they're not accurate a lot of times. And if they are, they might have reliability, but they're not valid. And they sure as shit don't understand context. They don't understand what's actually going on at the athlete's body, why they're making these choices. It's just giving you these very crude numbers. And so we wrote the book not to be anti-technology, because that doesn't work, but to more of say, like, here are the common mistakes with technology. Here's how to avoid them. Here's how to use it. And here's how to not get fooled by it and not ruin your personal training development or your coaching.
And, you know, we have this article, obviously, not near as in-depth as the book, but by Dr. Mike and Dr. James, called Fatigue Indicators and How to Use Them. And I'll try and remember to link that down the info. And
Sure.
And it deals with similar type of stuff. And HRV was one that I used myself for a while. And they talk about HRV monitors being a lagging indicator.
Oh, my gosh. Here. Yeah.
So it's kind of behind the curve and definitely not a good situation for, you know, each individual to use, but possibly a potentially a good tool for a coach to see, like, a team-wide trend.
Absolutely.
You know, but looking at it...
Or working with a new athlete that you haven't had a lot of exposure with. Things like that.
So being able to take the data and look at it, you know, and find the trend, so the next time that type of training comes around, they can better predict what's going to go on with it. And I'm looking forward to reading this book.
It's got a lot of pictures, so it'll be easy to read.
Fantastic. That's what I...
In color, too.
Yeah. I was going to have Max read it to me.
At night, reads me
bedtime
bed.
Stories.
Yes,
yeah.
Perfect.
Standard.
Yeah. Because they're in the last, you know, 3 years, 5 years, whatever it is, this huge, you know, prevalence of omega waves and HRVs and all this stuff. And what is definitely seemingly an over-reliance upon that by the professional coaching community, college strength coaches, NFL, NBA strength coaches, where, you know, I don't have money for an omega wave, so I don't have to worry about the data it's giving me overwhelming what I'm seeing with my own eyes. But it is certainly true that the athlete coach relationship and the coach's artistry of that and intuition, I think it's such a more powerful tool for those micro adjustments to training.
So one of the subliminal messages in the book, and I'm sort of giving you some teaser right now, because this is something we didn't put in there on the front cover in the book on purpose. This is something that we wanted to see people would get between the lines. But since you guys are so good, I'm going to go ahead and slide it to you right now. But we wrote the book, of course, because of the problems right now. But really, honestly, it's a projection in the future saying, if you think it's bad now, wait for 5 years. Wait for 20 years. it's going to be impossible to do what we do now, how we coach now, in 20 years because of data overload, because everything we're going to have. I mean, we already have these technologies available that can tell us your blood glucose levels with your phone. We're going to have sweat rate monitors, all this stuff that's inherent and built into us.
I don't need one of those. High.
A lot.
Right.
Mostly.
Red line. He's redlining on the sweat monitor. Everyone.
Right. So here's, I mean, imagine this scenario. You're a young coach right now and you're like, oh my gosh, if I want to get this job at Florida State, if I want to get this Division I job, I got to know how to use HRV and GPS tracking, et cetera. Right. And you build up this entire skill set to use all these technologies. But guess what? All that shit's going to be gone in a few years, because just like the iPod, when that first came out, and then 1,000 other little things came out, and then all of a sudden they realized, you know what, actually, we don't need that anymore because we'll just build it into your phone. Right. The same thing is going to happen with all this stuff. What you're learning now is going to be completely null and void in a year or two, 10, I don't know when it's going to be, but all this shit's going to go away, and everyone's going to be like, you know what, actually, we're just going to combine all this stuff into one app on your phone that's going to give you a score, train or not. And so you're going to waste a bunch of time learning a bunch of shit that's irrelevant, and look what you did to your own coaching skill. Right. You outsourced it, and now you don't have any. And that's going to be a real problem. And so one of the things that I project going forward, not a futurist, but I'm going to make this anyways, one of the things that's going to be extremely valuable in 10 or 15 or 20 years are things like coaching. Because everyone's going to have an app on their phone that's going to be able to have an algorithm with artificial intelligence that tells them exactly what to do. But people, because of that, people will crave the human interaction.
Terminator method, coined it. That's a TMCWS.
There you go.
Just get that.
Right. And so now if you develop the skill set to actually watch somebody and go, yeah, we're done today. And they're going to look at their app and go, and you're going to, I don't care what the app says, we're done today. And they're going to pay for that. And that's going to be so much more valuable and so much more effective.
Than I can tell people to stop all day long for payment. Yeah. That's not a problem. So are you saying that in the future, like, Alico barbells will just have the training program built into them? So you'll grab the bar and it'll tell you what to do? Maybe even make it you do it properly?
Yeah, sort of. Well, they're certainly going to have the velocity transducers. They're going to have position stuff. And it's going to transmit immediately to your phone and go, all right, you swung on that one.
Here's something that I think is interesting.
I think that's like the laser cleans.
Laser cleans, definitely. That's TM also. Yeah,
episode called The Future of Weightlifting.
Uh-oh.
In which we discuss at length laser cleans and hologram snatches.
Oh, there you go.
But it's also definitely happening.
And like failed drug tests and the weightlifting game dropped from the Olympics was the main thing.
Yeah. that's probably more likely than the first two. But
this definitely sounds like he's into the laser. He's on the laser clean.
Laser cleans are a thing. They're going to happen.
Like, so I'll give you a really tangible example. And we talk about something as simple as the technology as the mirror, right? So have you ever snatched in front of a mirror, like looking at the mirror?
Is there any other way?
Yeah, right? It's terrible, right?
That's how you see, like, your muscles.
Well, it depends what you're looking at. It depends who you are, right?
It's going to be awful. You're going to be terrible. It's weird. Right? You cannot develop.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you don't use the technology at all. Well, we just have to exchange the same thing. So any other of these training technologies, whether it's coaching, eye, dartfish, whatever else, right? There are some good things that a mirror can do. And there's some bad things that they can do. And so we need to develop appropriate relationships with them so that we can actually enhance our coaching and our training and not just become so reliant upon them. Because if you learned how to snatch in front of a mirror, do you know what happens the first time you walk out on a platform and there's no mirror foot in front of you?
Yeah.
Like, you're dead. I almost fell off the stage in Olympus in Birmingham at the American Open like 10 years ago.
Right.
Because I walked out and I was like, oh, what the hell is this? And we're elevated.
Where am I? Why can't I see myself? You know, something that's, and I don't know if it touches on here, but the first time I really heard someone talk about GPS technology and a microwave and all that stuff would have been 2011, and our mutual friend James Smith.
Sure.
And James Smith was telling me about Eric Corum, who at the time was at Florida State and sort of on the leading edge of a lot of this stuff, where a lot of James's ideas towards monitoring technology and the way to use GPS was in, you know, very special strength exercises, things that cannot be measured by, you know, pounds on a barbell, or they can't be loaded that way. And for that kind of thing, I think it's a more creative application of it. It's something that, you know, the app by itself is not going to just tell you, like, I'm trying to think of some of the really good, he was talking about measuring the velocity of medicine ball throws and all kind of different stuff like that. That type of technology, I don't think has been explored enough in it. It's almost too just looking at the the athlete feedback, but not so much of this more intensive monitoring of some of the exercises.
Yeah, and so again, the book is not an anti-technology book. We argue it's actually a pro-technology book. It's just a, we need to remember at all times when we're using them that we're not succumbing to data overload. Because if you collect a million data points and you run enough analyses, you'll find something. But is that actually the question that you should have asked? Maybe or maybe not. So the other thing to consider is when you take Florida State, for example, or any of those other ones, they probably have several, 2 to 3 sport scientists at all times on monitors at practice with those GPSs. If you don't have that, and you're just the one guy collecting, downloading the data, done for.
Yeah.
You're going to misinterpret. You're going to like, it's going to be all over the place.
Yeah, having the data and knowing what to do with it are two extremely different things.
We had Tim Ferriss wrote a section for the book for us, and one of the things he talked about was, you know, he has access to any data he wants on himself because he's got the funds and all the other things to do. And so we asked him, like, well, what ones do you use? And he's like, I only use technology to get data when I have a very specific question. So that your example sounds to me like an appropriate use where it says, I think this is going on. I can't tell. We got to figure something out here. Let's look for this. Okay, now implement the technology. But when we don't have that question, we just don't collect data for the sake of data collection because it's unuseful and, in fact, actually can be quite harmful for a lot of reasons. It could change our training. The other issue with those things, GPS or even specifically HRV, is the lack of understanding that you can change that. So you wake up and your HRV is in the tank. Okay, I get it. Well, why can't you go take a cold shower and change that? Well, you can, actually. Why can't you do some breathing drills and change that? You can, actually. GPS doesn't, or the HRV doesn't know that. And so if you're just waking up and being like, well, HRV's in the tank, guess I'm off today. Like, you're not going to get very far.
Right. Well, and like, you know, you could be using HRV, but also like taking a lot of Tren, and so your heart rate's really high. HRV doesn't know that you're obviously ready.
Right. Like, right.
Clearly you're ready.
Yeah. It just knows, wow, this guy's heart's about to explode.
Well, we were actually, when we were talking about earlier, Max, asking the basic questions of things like, well, it doesn't understand which training block you're in.
Right.
So, for example, if you're, well, I mean, I'm not picking HRV, we just happen to be on it right now, so I'm going. But you might wake up and the HRV says you're in the tank. Right. And we'll just make up a score. Say you have a score of 0 to 10, 10 being like absolute red, horrible, 1 being go. And you're at a 7 or something. Well, if you're in a training block that's trying to induce adaptation, if you wake up at a 7, tough shit. Like,
yeah,
go.
It's just there.
But if you're in a peaking phase, maybe that 7 now means, hey, throttle back. It doesn't understand that context, though. So you as a coach still have to be thinking through what the hell you're doing.
Yeah. It seems like there becomes a problem where people are trying to steer the ship too much during the process. So instead of saying, let's keep track of all these variables during this training program and not use them during the program, but afterward analyze them and say, okay, here's what happened. Run the same program again, analyze the variables again, and see if we get predictable results, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're just using variables and like, oh, my heart rate's tanked or whatever, like changing things all the time, we know that that doesn't equal a successful program.
No.
Not executing the plan for a long term, right? So I think that's kind of interesting that people get stuck in that, like you're saying, right? They probably get stuck in this idea of like, I got to do, you know, the computer says this, I got to do that, right?
No.
And a real common problem or mistake I see people making with it too is they're always trying to be recovered and they're neglecting the idea that if we were to say, you know, green, go ahead and train hard. Yellow, you know, you're kind of beat up. Red, you're very fatigued. Red plays in very, very. If you never go to red, you know, you're not doing the hardest training that you could be still making positive adaptations from.
So we have a chapter in there called, or a little mini section in there called adapting or optimizing.
Right.
It's one or the other. Right. If you, when you get to red, the more red you get, the more adaptation you get. Of course, the fine line there, though, is if we do too much, you break. Yep. But stress overload, I mean, call it whatever you want, this is when adaptation occurs. So if you don't do enough of that, you don't get enough adaptation, right? It's like the joke we said earlier, like, I'm not unfit, I'm just on a 5-year taper. It's like, great, I'm super recovered, I am fresh as shit.
Yeah.
But I'm not adapted. The other end of the spectrum is the optimization. So if you're optimizing, if you're waking up in the morning and you're sleeping 12 hours a night and you're fully hydrated and you're at a massive caloric surplus and you take your BCAAs and you took a nootropic and you got your MCT oils in your coffee going and you are just optimized to shit, you're going to have a great day, but we're not going to adapt that day.
Right.
Now, can we put ourselves on the other end of the spectrum? Can you still have a good training session when you are a little bit malnourished, underslept, these things, right? That's going to cause adaptation. And we have to understand, what are we doing? What's the purpose of today's workout, this week, this month, this block, this mesocycle, whatever I'm in? That is what determines, do we optimize or do we push adaptation? So maybe I have a training session where I train underfed. And I know I'm going to have a great session, but I'm trying to enhance a metabolic process.
Right.
Right. Or I'm not. Or I'm going to optimize and I'm going to have a great session today because I'm going to look for a big number. I'm going to sleep a little bit extra. I'm going to make sure I'm hydrated. I'll take my pre-work, whatever it is.
I think it's interesting because that's one area I see as a very common trend from knowing really good coaches and seeing the application of the training process to an individual versus the sort of like communal understanding of how training works, where it's, you know, train, recover, don't overtrain, don't do this. You know, the coaches are always on the side of, I'd rather do too much. Mm-hmm. I'd rather push too hard. It's better to be on that side because, for one, it's probably the nature of coaching and sport to be competitive, to push.
Right.
There's, no, it just seems like that side's always going to be, from the practical application of it, it's always going to be more to the side of, let's do too much. Like, I have to make sure we did enough. So you're probably going to overdo things and be a little on that side. Whereas the, you know, the clinical side, we could say, or the more, that side is going to be a little more of like a, you know, you don't have to do this much, or this is the exact amount.
Right. Minimum, right? Effective dose versus, yeah, exactly, maximal performance are, right, two different things.
Yeah. Yeah. And there, it's almost always kind of fuzzy to that side where it's still, you have excellent performance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah.
I think the minimum effective dose, and Dr. Mike's talked about this a bunch, is this idea of minimum effective dose versus maximum recoverable volume.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Totally.
Well, the minimum effective dose for what? To improve as fast as possible.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Then I guess they're moving towards each other.
Yeah, again, yeah. These are all questions of stepping back from the program and saying, well, what's the goal?
Right.
And once you identify that, then these questions are a little bit more obvious, right? So I'm not trying to do the minimum possible to get better. I will do that extra 80%,
yeah,
for that extra 20% gain. Because, right, I want that 20% is podium or not even qualified for the tournament.
Yeah. Right.
Like this is the major difference. And if we, the book really, it's fitness and performance stuff, and the last section is consciousness, and it really takes a more of like a metaphysical approach and steps back and says, like, well, how can we extend this to other areas of our life, which say relationships, getting out in nature, having the same approach with everything we do, and saying, like, well, how often in my life do I choose challenging, and how often do I choose suffering versus am I optimizing my life all the time?
You guys talk about compassionate touching.
Yeah. We talk about man-to-man touching.
Well, so it could be there, compassionate. I mean,
so no technology, no Tinder. That's just out.
Tinder's done. I didn't say out. but that's really what it's, you know, is it's about us saying, you know, for example, you have the physiological ability to go. What do you think the longest a human can go without food? What do you think the
7 years? That's probably not a good guess.
It's not a horrible guess. It's a lot closer than what most people think.
Without food?
Yeah, without food.
Are you one of those people that, like, doesn't eat food? Like, I've seen those stories on Facebook where it's like, man doesn't eat food.
No.
Couple discovers.
Did you see the burrito I ate today?
Yeah. What is the actual answer?
So, well, we don't know, but the scientifically documented is about 400 days.
400 days?
It's got about 400 days.
That's like, that's cut four on the RP diet, in case you're not sure.
Cut 400.
Yeah. So
400 days without food?
Yeah. Now, that guy was, I think, about 400 pounds, and he lost a couple of hundred pounds.
Well, that's not, right? Okay. He's clearly...
But take the rest of us. So if we can physiologically, in his case, go 400 days, I'm pretty sure all of us could go 24 hours.
Mm.
Right?
Hashtag powerlifting excuses comes into play there.
Right? So we have this ability to do things physiologically, but we're so worried about optimizing... We're willing to chill and to accept suffering and training because actually we like that kind of suffering. We like getting tired of the barbell. We like it heavy, right? But that's not really suffering then, is it?
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, I fucking hate being hungry. Well, then maybe choose that occasionally. I hate being cold. Choose that. Or I hate whatever happens to be.
Like people walking in front of you and stuff.
Oh, it's the worst, right?
Right?
Just the worst.
So...
So all kinds of things like that.
Interesting.
Where can they find the book and where can they learn more?
You have to buy it from this address right here. Show up in the house. They're all on the kitchen table. I'll give it out on my Instagram, the address to this place. I want to see that. No, I mean, it's up on Amazon. That's the best place to get it. Yeah, athleteunplugged.com, all that stuff. But Amazon, that's the best way.
And where can they learn more about you or connect with you?
So a couple of places. My social media is Dr. Andy Galpin, so Dr. Andy Galpin, Instagram, Twitter, all that stuff. And then I have a little, I guess we'll call it a podcast. Kenny Kane, the guy that was here yesterday.
Yes, yes.
So he and I have a little offshoot. It's only 9 episodes, so it's not like an online running one. And it's kind of like a combination of like a history slash radio lab, but for strength, conditioning, and muscle stuff. So we'll film like 40 or 50 hours and condense it to like 40 minutes. So it's just 9 episodes. It was short running. And we traced the history of powerlifting and weightlifting in America and how that evolved from bodybuilding. And
oh, cool.
So strength history.
Yeah, strength history stuff.
That's surprisingly the second time that the study of strength history has come up on this podcast.
Really?
Are you familiar with Mr. Ben Pollock?
No.
Strength historian.
He's very strong.
Oh, really?
He's a
U.S. Open champion powerlifter.
Oh, no, yeah.
All time.
How old?
He's 28, maybe?
28, yeah.
He goes, he's getting his PhD at University of Texas.
Okay, so the Todds, Jan and Todd, that's their stuff is what we use for our episode.
Well, I figured there's only like 5 other people that do it, so
I was
had
just,
to be them.
I was just with Terry a few weeks ago in Vegas. Like, that stuff is fantastic. So tell him to check out our episode.
Have you read a book called Muscle Town USA?
Okay.
You ever seen that?
No.
It's a really good book. It's all about, like, Bob Hoffman.
Yeah, yeah.
York Barbell.
We traced the whole story of all that.
It's a really good book, yeah.
Not all of our episodes are history. Some of them are like nutrition. Some just do different things. It's our way to kind of have like, I guess more. I don't know how to call it. Just different. Like we write the stories. We spend a lot of time writing, and they're built and they're crafted. So like little documentaries.
Oh, very cool. So what's that called?
That's called The Body of Knowledge.
The Body of Knowledge.
So that's been up, and we're actually about to start on Sunday. We start filming season 2.
Oh, nice.
So the first season was about change, and the second season is focused on Sherpas, so the people that help you up the mountain, down the mountain, and then also tell you, like, today's not a good day to climb. We take a bunch of different spins, and that's on, you can find that just bodyknowledge.com and iTunes, Stitcher, all that stuff.
Very cool.
And then my last one is my website, and this is one I wanted to make sure I get out. This is called andygalpin.com, and so I take...
Creative.
Yeah. I take all of my university lectures and all of my conference lectures and put them all up there for free. No newsletters, like no that? Like member. I don't give a shit.
Is there a pay webcam at all? Or
oh, I got pay webcam. That's a different website.
Okay,
that's just
DrAndyGalpin.org.
/manlove. Yeah, so that's all up there, and there's some up there. Now, but I'm going to continue to build that a lot right now and just throw as much.
Nice.
Basically, my goal is to put all the information somebody would need to get an undergraduate degree in strength conditioning and get it all up there for free.
Very cool.
Nice.
Montana.
You find me on Instagram, Max_Ada, Facebook. You can email me for questions about the Juggernaut online programming or online coaching at max@jtsstrength.com.
And I'm Chad Wesley Smith, at Chad Wesley Smith and at Juggernaut Training on Facebook and Instagram. Filling up your newsfeed all day. Make sure you visit juggernautcoaching.com for our online coaching services. Head over to the store and find all the places that Max and I will be next, teaching you how to lift things more better. Sometimes just up a little bit, sometimes above your head better. We have all kinds of clinics for that. And if you enjoy the videos, subscribe to the YouTube, head over to iTunes, give us a 5-star review, write us a funny review. We always enjoy those. And until the next time, Andy, thank you very much.
My pleasure, man. Thank you.
Max, thanks. You too.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not going to shake his hand.
Yeah. It's okay. I don't want to change your muscle fiber types too much.